la casa.
Eu queria cumprimentar.
Doutor, se não se importa, há um. Eu vou fazer uma introdução. Passe a palavra e iniciar.
If you don't mind, I will give people the floor. That's what was planned. Is that all right?
Falta um senhor ainda na sala, falta um deputado.
So there's still one member missing. He'll be arriving shortly, and then we'll be ready to start.
É, exatamente. Já está no sítio. Muito bem, quando quiser.
Good evening. The presence of the Conference of Presidents of the European Parliament in Lisbon and the Portuguese Parliament gives us a good opportunity to discuss the institutional relations of the European Union. We're in the Senate room of the Republican Assembly. We have the President of the European Parliament, Mr. Pickering, with us, as well as nine members of the Presidency representing the various political groups, as well as Jaime Gama, the Speaker of the Portuguese Parliament. We also have a large number of young people here with us from various educational establishments, as well as from party youth organizations. Portugal is taking over the EU presidency with a specific mandate, but a complex one. We have to prepare an interinstitutional treaty intended to give shape to the guidelines to govern the 27 member states with institutional reform. That's the subject of this debate, and I shall give Mr. Jaime Gama, the Speaker of the Portuguese National Parliament, the floor. Thank you. I would like to welcome Mr. Pickering, the President of the European Parliament, Mr. Manuel dos Santos, the Vice President, and the leaders of the political groups in the European Parliament from their various political families. And I'd like to tell you how delighted we are to bring you here together to discuss the future of Europe with a group of young Portuguese. Since 1834, this building, which goes back to the 16th century, has housed the Portuguese Parliament. Our country has achieved positive results, thanks to its membership of the European Union. Its per capita income has grown since accession sixfold. The numbers of students going on to secondary school, which is very important for young people, has grown by 3.5 times. And we've increased our enrollment by tenfold. So you can see we have good results. But it also shows that we need to look ahead. Following the Berlin summit, we need to look forward, given the decisions regarding the revision of the European treaties. We have been trusted in that. I'm sure the Portuguese presidency will be very demanding of itself and also of the European Union, so as to ensure that we come up with policies to meet our citizens' needs, particularly in the areas of better education and higher quality employment. We want Europe to be stronger in the world. We have 500 million Europeans today united in Europe. We account for 30% of the world product. And we have a great responsibility to bear. Our first major responsibility in building Europe consists of ensuring that all the countries feel equally comfortable within the European Union. And the whole world must feel comfortable with a stronger European Union. That's the challenge before us. And I hope that this debate won't be a propaganda session, but rather a critical debate in which the young people here, representing the various schools of political thought in Europe, can put all the questions they see fit to in a critical way. Because criticism is one of the great roots of Europe. Questioning rather than just accepting and taking as given. We have to build our common European home. That's our destiny. That's our future. Thank you. The President of the European Parliament and the Vice President will be meeting the President of Portugal, which will take over the presidency on the institutional text. I have a very direct question to Mr. Pickering, the President of the European Parliament. What strength may the European Parliament and the national parliaments have in the preparation of the new constitutional treaty?
Rivera, Caro President Jaime Gama, Vice President Manuel dos Santos, caros colegas, carissimos jovens portugueses.
My dear young Portuguese Europeans.
I've been asked as to the position of the European Parliament and the national parliaments and what role the national parliaments can play in the future. I'm going to answer this rather on a personal note, if I may. Since the first direct elections to the European Parliament, and that's 1979, when you were not even born, I have actually been myself a member of the European Parliament since then, and at that time the European Parliament had no legislative powers virtually. Now today, as far as 75% of European legislation is concerned, we are on a par with the Council in terms of legislative powers, and this is very important. It's a huge leap forward given the new treaty and the fact that the Portuguese presidency will have responsibility directly for this. This is something which is going to further enhance the European Parliament's powers and take us almost up to 100%, as I say, on a par with the Council of Ministers. This is a huge leap forward for democracy in Europe and for the European Parliament in particular. Now, the national parliaments are not regarded by us as competitors, but work within the same spirit of zeal and parliamentary spirit within the European Union. And as far as the reform treaty is concerned, the national parliaments will have the possibility to call on the Commission to scrutinize to review legislation. They'll have that power. And if the Commission remains with its initial decision, then the Parliament, the European Parliament, has to be questioned, and the Council of Europe, the European Council, has to be referred to. So this, in a way, thoroughly enhances the role of national parliaments in the future, which is why this is a very timely meeting this afternoon, so that you can be here to hear about the future of Europe and what the changes will mean for you. And we are here to tell you how you can prepare for your own future here in Europe. I would like to open the debate, you know, for some of the young people who are here this afternoon in the Assembly of the Republic. Joana Philippe, she represents the Young Parliamentarians Group. You have the floor. I'd like to address the leaders of the political groups. I'm extremely grateful that you're here, and I'd like to thank you for coming. I'd like to ask about the new political framework and the situation with regard to the war in Iraq. I found in the past a lot of ambiguity in terms of, above all, discrediting the national position and indeed the European position, the stance on Iraq. I'd like to know how the divergences which are there can be overcome, in your view, so that Europe can step forward as a real power with some influence, especially vis-à-vis the US. I shall give the floor to one of the members of the panel. I'd just like to remind you that what we're really supposed to be talking about is institutional reform, but who would like to take this question, please? Very briefly, I think that the subject which has just been raised by that first questioner is closely linked to the issue of the Constitution. We've been discussing the question of Iraq in the Parliament, and we actually had a resolution where there was a majority position within the European Parliament, which emerged a few weeks before the war. What does that prove? Well, it demonstrates that when you do have institutions which are in a position to decide on the basis of a majority, then you can occupy that ground. We believe that the problem which Europe has today in terms of questions relating to war and peace, the questions relating to democracy, very often what we're finding is that the governments alone cannot arrive at a European position. The same problem has arisen in conjunction with the Constitution. What we would like to see is the European Union being a forum for supranational democracy, so that we can have minorities and majorities. Sometimes we're on one side and sometimes we're on the other. As far as the question of democracy is concerned, these issues have not been satisfactorily resolved, particularly in terms of foreign policy, because even after this reform, we are still finding issues decided by unanimity in the Council, and this is the main difficulty. Joseph Daul here is the leader of the EPP group. On this question of foreign policy, we'd like to hear your views on this, because it's one of the most important changes in the reform treaty. And so the question to you really is, to what extent can external policy improve things through institutions as a result of the new treaty?
Oui, si vous permettez, on voudrait d'abord s'excuser, mais ça aussi c'est leur...
Well, I'm afraid that this is all part and parcel of living in Europe. We apologize for arriving late, and we'd like to thank you for waiting for us.
Je voudrais vous le dire, ça fait partie aussi.
It is, of course, in the nature of our work. We have to put up with these vicissitudes. We just have to accept it as part of our parliamentary life. I'd like to respond to your question. I'm from Alsace, the Alsace region of France, where we had a whole series of wars We had the 1914-18 war and the 1939-45 war and the war before that too. Now, this puts us in the position where we find ourselves today, and the achievements which are there are worthwhile as far as terrorism, as far as external foreign relations are concerned. We have not managed to work well enough together to resolve this problem of terrorism, and you're quite right in saying that no country alone can resolve any one of these issues, whatever the issues are. Most of them really are European, and with the new treaty we are moving towards a more of a policy in common, but we have other areas involving subsidiarity. The forefathers of Europe started this off 60 years ago. We've had 60 years of peace and stability, and we now have to have a much more globally European stance on all this.
So now, João Luís Santos, to continue the debate. Mr. President, honourable members, I have a question regarding the EU as a whole. Here it comes. To what extent is it actually a duty of the European Union to provide advice to a country such as Portugal, which has an aging population, which is not very wealthy, where the government has legalized abortion but doesn't have any sort of policy to promote people having children, as you have in Germany? Could I ask Martin Schulz, President of the European Socialists, to reply to that question?
Bear with me. When you talk about the aging population, it's difficult for me to field a question like that, particularly when I'm speaking to such a young audience, after all. It's difficult to answer really in an unemotional way. We might be able to have more discussions perhaps after the meeting as to what you can do in terms of an aging population, what kind of measures might be brought in, and I might be able to answer this more on an individual basis afterwards. Frankly, I don't think it's useful for the member countries of the Union to give instructions from Brussels in terms of what people should do about their demographic situation and what countries should do. I'm in favour of allowing the possibility of abortion, and I think that the decision which was taken in Portugal was correct. But I would also like to say that on the basis of my own conviction, it's not an instrument which can be used to regulate the population. What we need is a policy which will help and assist families. We want a society which wants to have the children and continue with family life, and where men and women can work together on an equal footing. And that's why we think it is a positive thing to support the family and provide a future for our populations. This is a value which is present not only in my society but in Portugal and elsewhere, and it is a sense really of being able to pass on life to the next generation. This is something which we need to do, that life is worth living, and we need to pass that very important value on to the next generation. Sometimes we've lost sight of it in the past. But it's not something that the European Union can alter, it's a societal issue really. One thing is important though, and that's this: if we don't manage to pass on that value, then we are an ageing continent, not just an ageing nation. 8% of the population lives in the 27 members of the Union, and that will be 4% by 2050. In other words, 96% of the population of the world will not live in Europe, but will live elsewhere outside Europe. It's an important statistic. It's going to bring a lot of problems in its wake. What we need then, obviously, is more children and less abortion.
Fine. Coming back to the reform of the institutional treaty, We'll turn to Mr. Graham Watson, the leader of the Alliance of Liberals and Democrats for Europe. We've been talking about values, and one of the essential values for Europe was the Charter of Fundamental Rights, which according to the new treaty will have binding force. But the United Kingdom will be omitted from that. The fact that the United Kingdom, such a significant country in Europe, remains outside the arrangements might undermine the Charter of Fundamental Rights, mightn't it?
Well, I come from the United Kingdom. I come from Scotland. I always feel a great affinity with Portugal. We live next to a very large country that sometimes tries to influence us. Look, I find it, as a liberal, incredible that a British Prime Minister can deprive his own citizens of the kind of rights that made our country respected around the world. He is not from my party. He calls himself a socialist, or at least Labour Party. But he has been so obsessed by the so-called war on terror that he has done a number of things in his own country to remove people's rights, to take away rights that they had. And now we have done at European level a Bill of Rights for all European citizens, and it has to apply everywhere, for everybody, in every country. And that must be a cornerstone of the European Union. And I believe that the European Court of Justice, whenever we have any jurisdiction on this, will uphold that. So I do not believe that Tony Blair will get away with depriving the UK people of the rights in the Charter of Fundamental Rights.
So from what you've said, it follows that the Charter of Fundamental Rights would be weakened if such an important country as the United Kingdom were not covered by it.
There can be no opt-out for fundamental rights. If we're building a European community, we're building a community based on values. And we can't allow Poland or the United Kingdom or Slovakia or any country that might have a government which does not share all of those values to get away with taking them away. Otherwise, we might as well give up. That has got to be a cornerstone of our union.
I give the floor to Vera Policat Coelho. Is she here?
Muito obrigada, Senhor Presidente.
Members, President, I'd like to pick up the last two issues, fundamental values of the European Union and those which are set out in the Charter, as well as the interests of future generations. And I'd also like to discuss in that connection the environment. We're well aware of the fact that in the treaty in force at the moment, environmental issues are key, particularly in the second and the sixth article. And as far as this issue is concerned, I'd like to ask two brief questions. I'd like to know whether the European Parliament is concerned about guaranteeing that in the next institutional treaty there should be not only these provisions, but also other important issues relating to the environment, whether in other words those articles are going to be extended. And also, what Parliament is trying to do to guarantee the provisions which are contained in Article 6. What is the European Parliament trying to do to make sure that is reflected in all the other decisions and right across the treaty? It's a cross-cutting article, tourism, agriculture, so on and so forth, and these are all issues which need to be approached with a great deal of care in terms of the environment. We know that we may have good environmental policies, but the CAP and the fisheries policy will tend to undermine the progress made in other areas. Thank you. We have Francis Schwartz from the GUE group. Perhaps would like to answer, or anybody else? Yes, Mr. Schwartz. Thank you. And I have to say that I'm delighted to hear these questions, because I think they are bringing in a very fresh note. I have to react on one thing which I think goes across all these issues, and that is before we can speak about institutions, we have to speak of values and even a vision of Europe for which these institutions have been, after all, designed. if you rule out war altogether as a way of resolving issues, perhaps this is something that should be in the charter verbatim. It isn't, and perhaps that is a weakness. That every woman should be free to take decisions relating to her own body should be in the charter. It's not there. That's a weakness as well. The environment. Parliament has considered that this is an extremely important concern, obviously, particularly in terms of global warming and also other aspects, energy, public transport, housing, properly insulated housing, energy-saving housing. There are a whole series of knock-on effects which will characterize a new concept of how we live in the future and how we produce, particularly in agriculture, as has been mentioned. Whenever we discuss institutional issues, we should always begin by considering what our fundamental visions and objectives are.
I'd like to ask Joseph Doll whether he endorses that opinion. Yes, indeed. You're probably putting the question to me in my capacity as a former member of the Agriculture Committee, but I'm a farmer. I have a small 9-hectare holding, just to give you an idea. As far as the agriculture policy is concerned, it seems to me that we faced a first challenge. We had to feed Europe because we had food shortages. We set up a policy which produced surpluses which were expensive for society as a whole. Today, I no longer see things purely in terms of the farmers. I'm thinking in terms of food safety, food security in the medium to longer term around the world. I think you're right. We do need to address these issues. And thereafter, for the benefit of our farmers, for our society, our consumers, we need to pose the real questions so that we can establish what policy we want to apply after 2013. We have a great responsibility to shoulder there. While respecting the environment, we have a huge responsibility to avoid making mistaken choices about the type of agricultural policy and food security policy we want for our 500 million consumers after 2013, so we can work together to come up with the right policy. That'll be out. Then on the same point, the climate and agriculture, could I ask Brian Crowley, the co-president of the Union for Europe of the Nations Group, to comment?
Thank you very much, and thank Vera for her question. The environment is the issue of the day and of the moment. And I believe it would be a mistake for us to say the issues in relation to the environment are X, Y, and Z, because as we now discover, they're far greater and go far deeper than just merely climate change, important in all of that is, or any other area. However, I also think that a lot of times some of the information that we're dealing with, if you look at things like the Common Fisheries Policy, yes, that does affect what should be a sustainable stock with regard to fishing, but it's also highly regulated at a European Union level, but it's not highly regulated outside of the European Union. And likewise with regard to the Common Agricultural Policy, if you look at the environmental damage done just with CO2 emissions alone, there is more CO2 emissions from the number of vehicles that are used on the roads in Europe than there is from all of agriculture in the European Union put together. Yet agriculture gets a bigger blame. And I think it's a mistake to say reform the CAP or stop the Common Agricultural Policy, we'll solve the environmental problems. Because as Joseph Doll has rightly said, our consumers are demanding proper quality of food, proper quality of animal welfare, and proper management of the environment. And we have now reformed the Common Agricultural Policy to audit farmers on how they use European Union money on condition that they meet certain rights and obligations with regard to protection of the environment and protection of animal welfare. And the last point that I would make, and again referring back to something that was mentioned earlier on by Georges with regard to the question of values and the European Union's values. The values that Jean Monnet and Robert Schuman and others had at the 60 years ago are different to the values of today. And the values of today will be different to the values that you will wish to see incorporated with any rights legislation in 10 years' time or 20 years' time. So we have to make sure that we're not inflexible in accommodating those new values and those new rights which arise. The basic values which should be part of every society, European Union or not, right to life, right to make a living, right to education, and the right to freedom to express your opinion. If those rights are guaranteed, all of the rights will fall into place.
I'm going to pick up one of the main questions facing the human race, and particularly Europe, climate change. We know that this will be guaranteed, we hope, to some extent, in the new treaty. What can the European Parliament do in more practical terms to fight this issue of climate change? I'd like to introduce Mr. Bondi for in the Independence Democracy Group.
I've almost got to the point, because the problem is exactly that we have an environmental policy where we have a possibility for making good minimum rules, where every member state can improve the rules on their own. Then we have a health policy where it's possible to improve the health standards on your own as well. And we have health and environment as horizontal principles which should be implemented in every single policy. And this is exactly the problem that it doesn't happen today. This is a battle where the Parliament takes a very good position. I can give you some examples. Denmark and Austria were forbidding F-gases, flue gases, destroying the climate. Then the Commission, according to other articles in the treaty, would then forbid us to forbid those products destroying the climate. In the end, the Parliament had an amendment approved, we negotiated a deal, and we were allowed to forbid the F-gases, the flue gases, destroying the climate. Then we have the pesticides in drinking water. Again, we won the battle. Then we have trans fat in McDonald's burgers and other areas of meals. And there we again were forbidden to forbid. In the end, we won the battle. So the European Parliament, in that capacity, we are able to try to force the horizontal principles into the concrete action, and this battle will go on. And on climate, we will have exactly the same problem. The transport policy will produce pollution, and we will then have to try to fight to reduce it. The agricultural policy, the beef lobby represented good here, they are in favor of destroying the health. We will have to make that battle on putting health before beef. We need to have health and environment as horizontal principles binding any other policy. It is in the treaty, but it's not implemented. It's a part, I think it's a fight most of us are part of. Not everyone, but most of us.
And now, the representative of the European Federalist, Leafy. Good evening. I'd like to thank you for this opportunity to be here. I'd like to thank the RTP, the European Parliament, and the Portuguese Parliament for this initiative. And might I suggest you do it more often. It's the exception rather the rule. It should be the way about. Now, I must say that the Federalist League is very sad to see the constitution being abandoned. We see that this is a step backwards rather than forward. But having said that, we have the following question. Given the disappointment of the hopes and expectations of citizens amongst member states who ratified the constitutional treaty, what do you think the European Parliament can provide by way of an explanation to citizens of those countries who have already ratified the constitutional treaty, and now telling them that it was for nothing? Let me give the floor to Bruno Gollnisch from the Independence, Tradition, Sovereignty Group, and others will have a chance to speak to him. Thank you for that question. I shall speak French, as I've forgotten my Portuguese. I think that's a very interesting question. I am one of those members of the European Parliament who were actually opposed to the Constitution, and because we were opposed to it, we also opposed the treaty. I'll give you some reassurance, because in this treaty, you'll find all the provisions regarding institutions that were in the Constitution. I have the Portuguese text here, the presidency's conclusions, and you'll see that all we're doing is avoiding the word Constitution. It avoids certain expressions such as law, framework law. They also avoid mentioning the flag and the hymn and the motto, but it's just a cosmetic exercise. So it's a very interesting text. If you look at it, you'll see that the Constitution is still there. So how can you be a European and be opposed to the Constitution, you ask? It's a false dilemma. Most of the people here are in favour of the Constitution. I, with some others, belong to the minority who were opposed to it. The reason is this. I think that, historically speaking, Europe is the part of the world which came up with this amazing thing that you find in no other civilization, namely the freedom and equality of nations. That's something which surprised the first Japanese samurais, for example, who visited Portugal in the 19th century. After 2 centuries of isolation, they saw that Portugal was living in peace next to Spain, thanks to the protection of international law. And although Spain was more powerful, it didn't try to absorb Portugal. So there are a number of different ways of conceiving Europe. We have our way of conceiving Europe, namely an international organization implementing specific cooperation policies which citizens can see the pros and cons of. It would guarantee shared security, it would have inviolable borders, it would be based on European values. But there are those who want to take it further. I believe they're wrong. They want a super state which will directly oversee the lives of 500 million Europeans. In the National Parliament in France, 80% of legislative work amounts to no more or less than the transposition of European provisions into national law. I'm speaking out with a dissident voice, so I have to keep it brief, but I'd like to come back to what was said earlier on about security. It seems to me that Europe must ensure security against a shared threat or attack. Cooperation here is perfectly legitimate. If we had had a defense and security policy driven by majority decisions, then all countries in Europe, even those member states who didn't want to get involved, would have been dragged into the Iraq War, just as they were dragged into the war in Kosovo. I'm one of those who feel that it wasn't in France's interest to take part in the Second Iraq War, nor in the Kosovo War. And we feel that each country, each people, must be free to decide on such issues. That is why I think that Portugal, in the name of François Henriques, the navigator and the poet, should remain an independent country, and your fate should be established here in Lisbon, not in Brussels. Now, Mr. Pittering, the President of the European Parliament, do you share that opinion?
Thank you for giving me the floor. I should ask for the floor to speak here in order to express to you what is actually majority position in the Parliament. Mr. Gernish was talking about the peace between Spain and Portugal. Of course, that was the case. But if we look at the rule has been in European history a rule of war, and it became almost compulsory for young Germans to fight young French soldiers or Polish soldiers or Spanish soldiers as well. This is a war-torn continent. And after the Second World War, the men, because politicians were mainly men then, but it's not the case today, said that this is something we have to do away with, we have to have reconciliation, we have to build a Europe together. And it wouldn't be Europe if the bigger countries were allowed to dominate. We need strong European institutions. We need a roof over our heads, as it were. And that's why we need a strong European Parliament. That's why we need a commission. And I think you can be proud in the president of the commission being from Portugal, President Barroso, not everybody agrees with me, that's a personal view, but I think you can be proud of him, and we need a Council of Ministers which is effective and which is strong. And in this common Europe, we find our own wishes reflected. It's not a super state, Mr. Gollnisch. Nobody wants a super state, certainly no one sitting around this table, but what we want is a strong democratic Europe which is in a position to act. And only when we have that can we be in a position to fully assume our identity in our towns, in our cities, in our regions. Only then can we defend that identity. Portugal can't go it alone, neither can any of the others. With more than 500 million people, we can do that. It's a fantastic achievement. It's a wonderful thing which we have managed to create, and we've seen the benefits of it in the past decades. It will be your job as the next generation, perhaps when you're sitting here in the Parliament or in the European Parliament or whatever responsibility you carry, you will understand the significance of this achievement. Freedom, democracy, human rights, peace above all, peace first and foremost, and that is the route we must pursue in the future. And that is why the vast majority of the European Parliament would be in favour of that.
On staff?
Carlos Moura from the Portuguese Youth, Socialist Youth Movement. No, I'm sorry, I'm President of the National Council for Youth Issues. You're not a socialist movement then? No. Sorry, that was the information I have written down here. I'm the President of the National Council for Youth, and I'd like to first of all begin by thanking you for this invitation and allowing us to have this opportunity to discuss the future of Europe with you. There are a couple of questions that our Council would like to see debated and see addressed by the Members of Parliament, and these are, first of all, during the Portuguese presidency, can we expect the Lisbon strategy to be revisited, particularly with regard to the Youth Pact? In other words, what kind of challenges do you expect to be dealt with, and how are young people going to be involved in the revision of the Lisbon strategy and in that pact? And above all, how is this going to impact on employment? That's a lot of questions, Carla. Perhaps we just deal with those. Mrs. Belohorska, observer from the non-attached group.
Thank you, ma'am. I think that not only the Europe is aging, but also the treaties are aging. So we need a new treaty and a new position. And I am so glad that Portuguese presidency begins with the new open the door and finish the discussion about the former treaty. Yesterday we had in the European Parliament excellent discussion with your representant from the Ministry of Health about one of the priority of the Portuguese presidency is the fight against the cancer, which is very important in Europe, and to common all our force against this bad disease. And I think also if we discussed before about the environment, health is a very important part of the environment, and I think it's also need a new position of the European Union, because the free movement without the free access to the healthcare, it's not the real free movement, so but it's the future, not for the next year, not for only for the Portuguese presidency, but for the next year.
A favor, dou a voz agora ao deputado.
And now, Mr. Watson.
Can I ask a question of your audience? How many people here think that globalization of the economy is a good thing? Put up your hand if you think globalization of the economy is a good thing. Okay. Now let's see the hands who think it's a bad thing. Anyone think globalization of the economy is a bad thing? No. Very good. The Lisbon strategy is all about how you prepare Europe for what is an increasingly global economy. It's how we can be competitive. Some people on this table will tell you that we don't want a liberal market economy because a liberal market economy takes no care of people. I would say, as a liberal, that the market is the most powerful tool that we have to make people richer. It's not a value in itself, but unless we have a competitive economy, we will not be able to provide good social security, good hospitals, good schools, good public transport, and so on. So let's do what the Portuguese presidency is planning to do. Let's have a competitive economy combined with a debate on how you can protect people who will lose their jobs in the transition period and how you can train them to be able to take advantage of the new opportunities of globalization. If you'd like to know more about this, buy my latest book. It's called Liberal Democracy and Globalization. You can order it from my website, www.grahamwatsonmep.org.
If I give Monica Frassini the floor. As we talk about the Lisbon strategy, Joseph Daul was one of its initiators. He had a lot to do with the inception of the Lisbon strategy and bringing citizens closer in terms of growth and employment. I think the forthcoming Portuguese presidency, with the institutional reform, might be able to take the Lisbon strategy, do you think? Well, madam, 5 years following the Council's decision in Lisbon on the Lisbon strategy, the European Parliament looked at what had been done, and we saw that not a lot of progress had been made. So we set up the Lisbon strategy group 5 years on, to look at the various elements on the economy and employment that you're familiar with. Over the last 5 years, I think that together with the national parliaments, we have managed to work on this strategy. And I would say that the national parliaments and national governments bear far more responsibility for implementing it, albeit in any European context, and I think we're on the right track to make a success of it. It's not just a question of liberalisation. I'm also liberal, perhaps not in quite the same vein as Graham Watson. Let me explain what I mean by liberalism. You have a football pitch, there are two teams, let the better team win, but you have rules for the game. There have to be those rules. We have to understand one another on this. You've got to have rules. If I could say to the young lady who put the question, on the Lisbon strategy, what we've been trying to do in the European Parliament is work together with the national governments and parliaments. How shall I put this? To ensure that there are higher purchasing power for our European citizens, a better quality of life. And I think over the 4 or 5 years in which we've been working together on the Lisbon strategy, discussing it and establishing European priorities together with national parliaments and governments, we have made a certain degree of headway. Not enough. You can never get fast enough, particularly for young people like yourselves. But we have managed to get the Lisbon strategy going again. But now we do need to push it further ahead. You don't have a book to sell, do you, by any chance? Monica Frassoni, co-president of the Greens. Thank you. I'd like to return to two points that were put. First, about the 18 countries who've ratified the Constitution, what should be said to them? I think we should say to them that this isn't the end of the story. At this point, perhaps, I'm not even certain about this myself, I think this is one of the great responsibilities of the Portuguese presidency, we need to try and save as much as we possibly can, and maybe even improve some of the provisions in the treaty now. We're not at all happy in the Green Group with what's happened to the Constitution. You can see the European Parliament is a normal Parliament. We have different groups and different ideas. And I repeat once again, decisions are taken by the majority. When you take a decision, things get done. That's the problem with Europe. That's why I don't agree so much with my friend Francis Vuitier when he says that institutions can be tacked on later. No, you have to have democratic, open institutions which are able to take decisions. Our problem in Europe is that decision-making is a very weak and difficult process. And there's a problem here. to the 18 countries who ratify the Constitutional Treaty, we have to say we have to continue the process. Even if we don't get 27 ratifying, even if some say behind because they don't want to get involved, not because they can't, the issue of democracy hasn't been addressed yet. And then on environmental issues, this isn't a question of fashion, this is hard policy. We're a very vociferous group in the European Parliament, we constantly speak out, but we don't always win because we have to win over the gentlemen to my left. And it's very difficult, because when it comes to renewable energies, motor cars, farming, GMOs, these are difficult issues. And there's a huge need for people who understand more of the issues to back us up on this. It's a tough battle to fight. And the lobbies are there saying, oh, it's not that serious, we can sort this out, don't worry. You go off on your holidays in huge cars because they're safer. Much has to be done at national level, but also in the European context. Congratulations on your Portuguese, says Escapus Ferreira. Martin Schulz.
First
of all, the young lady having insisted that she's not a socialist, well, of course, you can change a lot of things as you go along.
Die Abstimmung, die der Kollege Wort.
The vote. The vote which has just been carried out, the straw poll which Graham Watson has just carried out and his publicity for his book has been very interesting. I'm in the book trade too, but I'm not trying to sell any books at the moment. Now, it's easy to say we're all in favour of globalisation. Globalisation, yes, if it benefits everybody and if it's fair. But the fact of the matter is that it's not the case. Not everybody benefits from globalisation. Perhaps for the broker in the London city, globalisation sounds just great. But perhaps for somebody working here in a factory, in a car factory perhaps, here in Portugal, just out of a job, it sounds much more dangerous. And if you have a liberal like Graham Watson saying, globalisation is great, then we can all say, yes, but let's have some rules of the game. And let's see that if we had those rules, if you had that straw poll, you'd get the same kind of result as you got a moment ago. Globalisation can be a good thing if it contains three things. First of all, it has to be used to do something about reducing hunger and misery in the world. That's point number one, and the Portuguese government has got it right. They're the ones who say Africa has to benefit from globalisation as well. Number two, globalisation is a good thing if it's not putting the major financial forces in the world in a position where they can buy up companies and sell off companies and make thousands redundant in the meantime. If we make rules to make this impossible, globalization is a good thing. Number three, our earth is under threat. If economic growth rates continue in Asia, in China and elsewhere, hand in hand with the kind of energy consumption that we've seen in the West, then our Earth is threatened with a very negative fate. But if we move forward with cleaner energy, which is more job creating, we'll be benefiting not only our own economies, but economies in the rest of the world. Then globalization will be a good thing. But then, and only then. Go and ask the Soviet Union if they think globalization is a good thing for former Soviet Union. I don't know what they would say to that. There would have to be rules for it to be a good thing.
Do we have a representative from the Republican from the Partido Popular here? Are you there? I hope I've got that right. You are from the Partido Popular, right? Yes, you've got that quite right, and I'm delighted to be from that party. Good evening, everyone. I'm not a socialist. I'm sure most of you will have grasped that. The question I wanted to put is to do with competitiveness and tax policy in the European Union. I think we all agree here that we need a strong European Union which will be competitive. But in order to ensure that there is that competitiveness, then the taxation policy has to be such as to allow each member state to decide what's best and what it feels is the right course for that country to follow to overcome its obstacles. So my question is this. What plans does the European Union have in terms of taxation policy? Is there a push towards a uniform approach? Now we have the euro, Brett thinks it was like. You're trying to regulate the market. I don't have any book to sell, certainly don't have a recipe for liberalisation, but isn't overregulation always a mistake? I'd like to sound out your plans on taxation policy, Sibiots. Thank you. Your question will allow me to give you a specific example of the relationship between what we want Europe to do and the institutions we provide in order for it to do the job. Those who are in favour of qualified majority voting in the widest possible number of areas are very often the very same people who, when it comes to taxation or social provisions, just as you have in mind yourself, want to stick to unanimity. Why is that? It's because, you know, that is the way you can prevent tax harmonisation, though that is a prerequisite for the smooth working of the community. We have the European Union now, where the members wage economic warfare on one another by means of tax dumping, and that absolutely has to change. Unfortunately, in the treaty, as just reopened for reconstruction, unanimity on tax matters will remain. I think we need qualified majority voting if we are to prevent the blockages by the more liberal-minded states. And I'd like to move on to the issue of regulation versus deregulation here. I think that lies at the core of a feeling of social unease which is spreading right across the European Union as people look at the current European institutions. Commissioner McCreevy, who's responsible for the internal market, provided a very apposite explanation, as I see it. I'm very much opposed to what he was saying, but I think it's a very accurate description of the facts. The single market is by far the biggest such regulation in European history. That's why many people can't see their views reflected in this concept of the building of Europe. Now, as we've been invited along by the President of Parliament to a critical debate, I'm grateful for this opportunity, my criticism of the current thrust of the European Union is very different from that voiced by Mr. Gornish. I don't have a problem with the European flag or the European hymn. I'm in favour of Europe. If we didn't have Europe in the world today, we'd have to invent it. But I'm in favour of a Europe which will have a social priority. For the sake of competitiveness, the European Central Bank president came along to the European Trade Union Confederation conference recently and said, you've got to accept wage moderation, competitive pricing, you've got to help fight inflation, you've got to agree to wage cuts. And the whole ETU, see, rose up against him. But this is one of the main policy thrusts in Europe at the moment, and we need to fight it for Europe's sake. That's what we need to be saying. Similarly, Mr. Steinbrück, the German finance minister, who is still presiding over the ECOFIN Council, said himself in a small meeting, although this is in the public domain, was that the crisis of Europe was the crisis of economic and financial legitimacy. Well, that's absolutely true, but nothing was said about this in the recent European Council regarding the future treaty. So there should be no taboos, and I'm looking to the Portuguese presidency to ensure that at the intergovernmental conference these taboo matters are brought up for debate again. And I'm counting on public opinion, I would add, to force our leaders to move on this, because it seems to me that is the way that we will open up the path to overcoming the crisis of confidence amongst our citizens. Brian Crowley has the floor.
And again, if I can answer the two questions very briefly.
Yes, what's the reply?
Tax harmonization. Look at the facts. Where you have effective, some may call it liberal, but I call it realistic taxation policy on business, on industry, on personal taxation, economic output grows. Tax revenues grow to that stage. Therefore, you can spend more money on your social model, whether it's pension provision, health provision, education provision. It would be a mistake and an error for Europe to have a harmonized taxation system. And again, just look at the examples. The two most recent models of tax harmonization in a large single market area that we have before us is China and the USSR. Now, if you want to go down the road of utilizing tax revenue in the way that these two systems seem to operate, so be it. But other things will suffer because of that. So I think it would be a mistake and an error that we would have tax harmonization policy. On the question of competition, yes, we are competing on a global scale now. We are competing with lower labor costs in China and India. I don't believe that workers in the European Union should go down to the same level of labor costs that they are, labour wages that they get in China or India. I believe our task should be forcing those countries to give real returns to their workers for what they've got, whilst at the same time giving our workers and the people employed in the European Union the skills to be able to compete in those areas. And finally, from Carla's question about the National Youth Council, and you asked, will the youth voice be heard in the Lisbon Strategy Review? It's up to you to determine that the voice of youth is heard. And it's up to people like you right across the European Union to contact us as members of the European Parliament or your own national parliaments to ensure that the voice of youth is heard today. You've never had a greater opportunity with internet and open access and so on to have that voice brought forward. And you have a very strong voice. I mean, and I can say this with some expertise, there's nothing politicians hate more than an organised group who want something just before they have to go for an election. So if you have a single focus and a single ideal you want to bring forward, you will get responses.
Pedro Vaz, from the Socialist Youth Group, I hope. I've got that right. Yes, that's correct. Yes, somebody here from your political family, Mr. Schultz. What I'd like to ask is this. It's a simple question, really. We're looking at different political families before us today. And do you think there's a democratic deficit in the Union? Very often at a national level, people shirk off responsibilities for some of the unpopular decisions which have to be made, blaming it on the European Union. So the question really is, who can the European citizens blame or judge for the decisions which are taken? Many of these decisions are unpopular, of course, and many of them actually undermine social rights.
Thanks.
They
ask you to be very brief.
We should overcome the democratic deficit. We should start to ask you, do you like this constitution, yes or not? You should be asked in a referendum. That's where democracy starts. You ask the people. And then we should look at the lack of democracy in the constitution, to my mind, because this is, what is a democracy? The core is you go for elections, have a new majority, and then a new law. And the problem with the existing rules, as well as the constitution, is that you can go for elections, but you can't change the law. Because only the commission in Brussels, the non-elected, have the possibility to propose a new law. And only a qualified majority in the council, a very big majority in the council, can approve a law. A majority in the parliament cannot approve the law. We can only put forward amendments to laws, and then the non-elected decide if it's good amendments we have proposed or not. So I think what we are really missing, that is democracy. We should have a rule that all laws should pass the council, plus a simple majority in the European Parliament. Then you can go for elections. Then you can change the laws. You can't do that today. We have a vast democratic deficit. It will be increased to 50, more than 50 new areas for the Constitution. So I warn you, read that document before you approve it.
I believe my colleague's question is actually aiming at something else, but it is essential when trying to address the crisis in the European Union. We're not looking at a crisis of institutions. The Commission and its president, of whom my president here is so fond, in political terms, I'm not so affiliated to him, I have to say, but anyway, Mr. Barroso's Commission, or we in the European Parliament, can act. But what we saw once again last weekend is that it is the governments of member states who are not in a position to govern very often and not able to decide. If you get 27 of them together sitting around the table, what you find is really reciprocal blockades. And what you have is sovereign states meeting around a table and cannot, unable to agree, even behind closed doors. And everybody then turns around and says, well, it's Europe's fault. No, it isn't. It is national, selfish national interest. It's exactly the opposite of what we mean by European democracy. Where we have received some strength in terms of the new treaty, this is something which is going to help us because we're going to be much more involved in getting laws on the right track in the next few years. Well, there are some differences, clearly. There are bound to be. It's a healthy process. First of all, Joseph Stoll, before we have another speaker from the floor. Well, very, very quickly. The Parliament is democratically elected. That's important to know. It's the European citizens who vote in the European Parliament elections. And once we're there, and we agree with you, we have to shoulder our responsibilities for 5 years. If we haven't done a good job, we're out in the next election, aren't we? So, at a certain point in time, you can't keep having referendum for the sake of it. We have a responsibility to shoulder, and you decide whether you keep us in or not. That's all well and good. And it's all well and good also that in the Constitution that we should have more powers. And ultimately, we have to work together with 27 countries to find compromises, even to a greater extent than the Council. What we try to do in this democratically elected Parliament over a five-year period is to find compromises for the benefit of Europe. It's true, it's harder with 27 member states. I look at the Democrats in my midst, and I have to repeat once again that we are democratically elected and we have to shoulder our responsibilities, and we do that. Yes? Good afternoon. Well, what has happened today is exactly what I was expecting. That is that we've spent about an hour here, and nobody's mentioned the word culture. Culture is, after all, fundamental for any state or group of states. It's something which is sometimes can be uncomfortable, it can provoke conflicts, and this brings us back to the very essence of what it is to be human. I think it's necessary to say, in this respect, that anybody who might decide to become a pianist in Portugal has to buy a piano. He would need 20 times the national minimum salary. And if you go to another European country, it's 15 or 6. What you can see is a huge difference in terms of purchasing power and therefore opportunities. I'd like to know when you think that in practical terms Europe will provide equal opportunities for all young people.
Mr. Dahl, can I just make a suggestion? Can I ask you how many minimum salaries did you need to buy a piano before Portugal joined the European Union? I think the European Union has made things better, hasn't it? Well, yes, of course, Europe has made a very positive contribution, but when you talk about a group of countries, if I could put it that way, we work from the premise that we would all be able to live in the same way. At least that was the objective. I'm not saying that Europe has been negative. I'm just saying that we haven't done quite so well out of this as others. Francis Fields. There is a cultural dimension which does hinge directly on Europe, and I'm surprised that no one has mentioned this so far, given that we have a group of young people here. There are the Erasmus scholarships. They allow young students to spend an academic year in another European country as part of their studies. It seems to me that if ever there was an extremely positive measure in European policy, it was surely the Erasmus scholarships. What I regret is the low budget assigned to them, because as things stand today, only something like 1% of European students have enjoyed such a scholarship. That's obviously ludicrously low, but this is a wonderful cultural tool, not only because it allows you to come into contact with other cultures and languages, it also encourages people to be open-minded. And so it prepares you for a modern, tolerant, fraternal vision of the world. So for my own part, in the European Parliament, together with my group, I'm calling for substantial increases to the Erasmus scholarship provisions to try and overcome these inequalities, because if you only have 1% of students enjoying this, it's a privilege rather than a right. So we want all young Europeans to have access to this. I should add that the Prime Minister will be meeting young Portuguese scholars from various countries in Portugal very shortly. Yes, do come in, repeat your brief, because we want to take another question, and we're coming to the final stage of the debate.
If I may, I'd like to comment on the points made by Francis Woods. You may know that as far as the financial framework from 2007 to 2013, it was established under the Austrian presidency. There was a summit in Brussels, and heads of state and government took a decision, and everybody thought that was the end of it. And when that was discussed, we talked to the federal chancellor, and we said, if this decision is not changed, then the European Parliament will throw it out. And we got into a situation there where I think the Erasmus funding was increased by about 2 million. We insisted on that as the European Parliament. The governments couldn't agree it amongst themselves. We never do everything right. Nobody ever does. No political party does either, even if they think that they have brought the truth. Nobody has that pearl of wisdom, that pearl of ultimate wisdom. But if we can be proud of anything in the European Parliament, and I think we can, this is one example. In other words, measures for youth, measures for Erasmus, that funding was drastically increased as a result of the European Parliament's insistence. And so this is a good example of where we had the courage of our convictions and were able to bring that influence to bear on the heads of state and government. Pedro Goma. Representing the Youth Parliament, I'd just like to welcome the President of the European Parliament and the leaders of the political groups, as well as the other members of the panel. I'd like to begin by saying that Portugal is proud of having Durão Barroso as President of the Commission, and I really think it's brought home to us what Europe really means. There's a lot of criticism which we can make, but I think we ought to be proud of our President's achievement in this sphere, and also because we really feel that initiatives of this kind, of the very essence of Europe, this kind of meeting that we've had this afternoon, I'd like to thank you for that. My question, should the European Union perhaps take more care in terms of other major powers such as China? If I mention this, it's because we have had all these Chinese shops setting up in Portugal. It's a very close example. We actually are beginning to think there ought to be more protection against this invasion.
we've already had the question about protection. So can we move on and have the representative from the National Scoutmen? Good afternoon, everyone. We're talking about the course we are set up on to create Europe. Single market. But in youth association movements, you need skills which will equip you for young people's lives. Could you come to your question, please? There's not much time. When building up a real European employment market, how are we going to recognise the skills that people require in youth association work? What are you going to do with youngsters who have been active in associations? How can they have their skills which are not fully recognised in a diploma acknowledged? I'll ask Brian Coley, Graham Watson, and then the President of the European Parliament to reply.
Thank you very much.
No more time, sorry.
As a coach myself, I want to say that the work and the ethic that you get from being involved in a volunteer movement as a young person stays with you for life. And it's not so much what Europe can do when people get older to continue on doing that work, it's the example that you give by your volunteerism. And maybe that's one of the things that's missing out of what the European project is about. There's a lot of economics, there's a lot of environmental, and there's a lot of social, but the actual volunteer aspect of it is only in the last week we had a meeting in the European Parliament of a European Volunteer Association 4 years ago with the European Year of Volunteers. And there was a huge response to those kind of initiatives. And I think that, again, it's up to yourself and associations like you to make us aware of what needs to be done, because you've skills that a lot of us could never have, and you've insights that a lot of us have never seen either, and that can be a benefit for you. Sorry.
Martin?
Thank you. I'll try to be just as brief. Now look, we've just done something very, very important. We've just established political foundations at European level to help promote democracy through the study of politics and society. Political foundations that will be able to help youth parliaments to do their work. That's hugely important. Our education ministers are working on a project to try to get a common European history book written so that we can teach European history on an agreed basis in all of our schools. That is hugely important for European culture. And when we have built this kind of society of a participative democracy, then we will be better able to deal with Pedro's point of how we tackle China, because there we've got a long way to go to convince the Chinese that democracy is the right way for the future. In the meantime, there's a market opportunity for an importer of pianos from Taiwan. Perhaps we can work on it together.
Lots of other people would have liked to put their questions, but we don't have enough time for that. So I'd like to ask the President of the European Parliament to tell us how the European Parliament views the Portuguese presidency and how your political group views this. Do you think there should be a referendum to alter the treaty? And we have people here representing the Portuguese Parliament, so they'd be interested in your answer to that question.
Yeah, see,
you've put some questions, it's up to me to answer. I'd like to begin by saying that I feel very confident that the Portuguese presidency will be a successful one. And I have had occasion to work with José Sócrates, your Prime Minister. He belongs, of course, to Martin Schulz's political family. And I've had excellent cooperation with the President of the European Commission thus far. He's a social democrat, of course. But this is not far removed from our own political group. I don't want to speak on a partisan basis, though. I'm speaking as President of the European Parliament. I have worked well with both. And I really feel that what is important is that we carry a responsibility for Europe in our work. And what I'd like to say in these concluding remarks is that the Federal Chancellor Angela Merkel said to the European Parliament yesterday, confidence takes years to develop and sometimes decades, but you can destroy confidence in one evening. And she was thinking about the discussions in Brussels. And I'd like to pass on some advice to you, if I may. First of all, it's interesting, I think, to learn other languages, as you all have done. I'd like to be able to speak Portuguese to you, but I can't. I had an aunt who attended a Portuguese school because she lived here for some years. So I visited the area around here, and I'm quite familiar with it. But that's my experience of languages, and I think language is very important. But my final point is this, really. Confidence has to be allowed to develop, and that can only happen if you listen. And if you listen properly, then you learn. And if you learn, then you understand. And only through understanding of each other, because after all, this is a diverse culture in Europe, but it's a very rich culture. What we have to try to achieve is that we base our values on that diversity and preserve that diversity. That is a way of preserving our values. And this means that we have to be ready to learn and we have to be ready to make compromises. If somebody wants to put his view across 100% risks destroying this basis. And it has to mean that all countries in Europe, the smaller and the larger ones, have to be prepared to make compromises so that we can develop this confidence in peace and in a legal structure. So that is what we have to do, and that is your political responsibility here in Portugal and in Europe. I'd like to thank you for this extremely lively and interesting discussion we've had this afternoon, and I wish you all the very best. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I think it would be a little premature to talk about the method of ratifying the treaty. Do you think it's premature to suggest what ratification method for the treaty might be used?
Referendum
europeo, the Greens says we should have a European referendum.
On ratification, we have made no decision on whether there should be a referendum or not. And what I say now is in my personal capacity. I would have preferred, if it had been possible, to have a referendum on the same day in all member states. That hasn't been possible, but it would have meant that a no could have been outvoted by a yes where this might have occurred. Unfortunately, that hasn't been possible, and that's why I would have been in favour of this Europe-wide referendum. But it has to be a national decision now, in any case, whether there's going to be a referendum in a given member state or not. I myself am a supporter of the parliamentary system. In other words, the national politicians have to bear responsibility for these decisions through a parliament. I think the decision should be made through parliaments personally, but of course this is up to member states to decide, and everyone has their own opinion on this. We cannot, in any case, set down instructions from the European Parliament. It'll be up to President Cavaco Silva, Prime Minister Socrates, and the political parties to make those decisions for Portugal, whether it would be a decision taken through the parliamentary procedure or through a referendum. My preference would be for the first. Victorian Canas.
Thank you. May I say that I've greatly enjoyed this very lively, dynamic debate. We've heard a lot of points of view expressed. Sometimes it may be difficult to see exactly where the dividing line is when you hear such a wide range of views. But I think we've had a very positive debate. And this is the kind of debate that we enjoy hearing in the Portuguese Parliament. May I tell you that I believe Europe is setting off on a new stage now, not just because of the decisions to be taken and the degree of consensus which was achieved at the recent European Council meeting, rather because we can see a fresh growth of optimism in Europe amongst European citizens. And it's very positive that Portugal is taking the presidency in this atmosphere, because we can contribute to the future foundation of Europe. This institutional debate in Europe is very important, but it's hardly surprising that a wide range of other issues have arisen. People talk about the associations movement, globalization, climate change, culture, taxation. A large number of issues have been raised. In order to address them, the European institutions are preparing a new step forward for Europe in this new treaty. The intention behind the treaty is to respond to these concerns. This should provide leadership, confidence and optimism for Europe. And I think that young people are the source of those three factors which Europe needs, because the future of Europe lies more in your hands than ours. Thank you. Thank you. That brings to an end the debate of the European Parliament's Conference of Presidents on the verge of the Portuguese presidency, a unique time in Portugal's history where Portugal holds the presidency of the European Commission in the person of Mr. João Barroso, while at the same time José Socrates, the Portuguese Prime Minister, is about to become the President in Office of the European Council. Thank you.